It's a pleasure to welcome Mark Rubenstein, author of Net Interest. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, John.
Hi. So, Mark, this week you write a very insightful, in-depth piece on Citigroup, a company that just announced but actually today is the effective date of a new CEO taking hold.
That's right. That's right. Jane Fraser, she's the first female chief executive of a Wall Street firm. She takes the job as of today, 1st of March.
Well, you go into a lot of context and history of Citigroup, which I found fascinating because it just underlines the point that companies like Citigroup can be very cyclical and over a very, very long period of time may not be compounders in the sense of the word, but there have been some notable opportunities along that stretch of time. And you do a great job of explaining how those came about and who managed to take advantage.
It's interesting that there's so much focus right now on growth stocks and the concept of growth versus value. I thought it would be interesting, and there is some speculation that maybe given events that have occurred recently, maybe that balance is starting to shift a little bit. So I thought it would be interesting to look at the long-term record of a stock, which I consider a value stock, which is Citigroup. And its long-term record takes us as far back as 1812. And there's been sufficient history about the company written that we're able to understand who throughout its history has been successful at playing the stock from a value perspective. And I identified about five episodes where it represented a significant opportunity for value investors and was able to identify at least three individuals who were able to exploit that.
And it's amazing how much history we have to look back on with Citigroup. I think it's probably quite unique in that respect. 200 years just about of a track record and history we can examine.
Precisely. And it's always been big. Interestingly, it was the biggest bank in America already by the end of the 1890s. It was the biggest bank in the world by 1929. So it's always been a big bank. And what's interesting too is that its strategy, and again, the hook relates back to a new CEO taking the reins as of today, that a lot of the DNA that she's going to be working with, a lot of the attributes that make Citigroup what it is today, were laid in the ground many, many years ago. So it's now known as a global bank. And one of the challenges that she will face is how to manage such a large entity that is Citigroup from a global perspective. But it was the first American bank to open up a foreign branch back in 1914. So for over 100 years of DNA that she's grappling with.
So let's examine some of the history. What were some of the key moments and some of the key people?
So it starts, as I say, it was founded in 1812. It was founded a few weeks before the outbreak of the War of 1812, which I must confess my own ignorance of American history when doing research for this piece. In Europe, we think of the War of 1812 as being a Napoleonic War. In addition, the Americans were at war with Great Britain in the War of 1812, and to fund that war, they turned to banks, and Citigroup was known then as the City Bank of New York, had just been founded and helped fund part of that war effort. It carried on building. It had one branch in Manhattan. That was about it. It carried on building up its business over the 1812s into the 1820s. And in the 1825, it ran into problems. And a merchant called Charles Lawton bought stock. He actually bought a majority share in the company the Citibank of New York. And it's on record that he bought it for 0.55 actually, no, I'll come back to that. That was John Jacob Astor. I'll come back to that. But he bought it cheap and he sold it and he made a very quick profit. And then John Jacob Astor in 1837 was the second value investor to dip his toes into the Citigroup story. In 1837, there was a financial panic in the United States. Many banks actually went bankrupt. One of the features of the century, of the 19th century, was the degree to which banks would often run into problems. And we'll see that pick up momentum towards the end of that century. But in 1837, there was a financial panic. John Jacob Astor, richest man in America, bought stock. He bought it at 0.55 of par, observed the turnaround and was able to ride it all the way back up to 1.2 times par. He had an acquaintance, a man named Moses Taylor, who he installed onto the board. So Moses Taylor joined the board. He went on to be the president, one of the most successful presidents, chief executives of what would become Citigroup of all time. And personally invested alongside Astor a lot of his own funds in the stock of Citibank, and did very, very well out of that. We can talk in a while about how he did so well and what his management strategy was. But as a result of his investments broadly, but specifically in Citibank, he died a very wealthy man with a fortune of what in today's money would be $1 billion.
Well, what's interesting to me is these very successful investments in Citigroup appear to all have come in after some kind of crisis.
Exactly. So the other thing I do in my piece, in my history of Citigroup, is weave in some quotes from Howard Marks, who clearly has got some very interesting things to say about investing broadly and specifically value investing. And one of the things he says in his book, The Most Important Thing, is he says there's two rules in investing. Rule number one is most things will prove to be cyclical. Rule number two, some of the greatest opportunities for gain and loss come when other people forget rule number one. And certainly throughout the history of Citigroup, these opportunities have emerged when the stock has been and the company's performance has been at a cyclical low. Now, clearly, and we'll go on to talk later about the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, the idea that what can put cyclicality off kilter is solvency, but to the degree that Citibank or any bank or any company remains solvent, then that cyclicality inherent in its performance can be, and inherent in the way other people value its performance, can be very instructive. And both Charles Lawton in 1825 and then Astor in 1837, they saw a cyclical low, and that's what they exploited.
And then following that period, there was the Charles Mitchell period, which I also found fascinating because it exposed that cyclicality doesn't necessarily turn favorable when one wants it to.
Precisely. It almost takes a generation of turnover to forget. It's something Morgan Housel has written about in his writings, the idea that investors or managers of companies are heavily influenced by experiences in their formative years. Moses Taylor was heavily influenced by the financial panic of 1837, and he retained a very tight ship, a fortress-like balance sheet around Citi over the period in which he ran it. Its capital ratios were very, very high, and it was able to avoid all the subsequent problems going into the 1890s, when more and more financial panics happened. Citi was actually able to benefit from those and accumulate market share. So we said right at the start of this discussion that by the end of the 1890s, Citi was the biggest Bank of America, and it did that by being solid in the way JP Morgan actually was following the financial crisis of 2007-2008, being more solid than its peers, able therefore to accumulate share. However, that message was forgotten at the turn of the 20th century, and Charles Mitchell became the president. He became the president of the bank at the kind of, it was at the end of the, following the First World War. And he had a slightly different perspective. He cleaned up some problems that the bank had fallen into in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. But hey, this was the 1920s. And as we used this quote when we spoke a few weeks ago, the Chuck Prince quote, who was a subsequent chief executive of CEO, about the music that one has to get up and dance when the music is playing, and in the 1920s everyone was dancing. And so he already in 1914 Citi had established outposts abroad, some branches in countries, specifically in Latin America, big growth market in those days. He set up branches in Uruguay, in Argentina, put one down in Cuba. And he basically invested very heavily in those branches. Cuba had suffered some sugar-related losses. He doubled down on that, actually went into the sugar production business. He increased the number of branches globally, all the way up to almost 100. And more than anything, remember, this was the 1920s, he wanted to bring Wall Street to Main Street. And already Citi had a subsidiary. This was before Glass-Steagall, which required banking and brokerage to be separated. Prior to that, Citi had set up a brokerage subsidiary. Actually, Mitchell came to the bank through that subsidiary, and he invested very heavily in it. He opened brokerage offices right across the US, and Citi, the bank, did a lot of lending to Citi, National Citi, the brokerage company, and those businesses became increasingly intertwined. So by 1929, Citi was now the largest bank in the world, had nearly 100 branches globally. It was very heavily involved in countries like Cuba. It was lending also to Germany and to Chile, and it was very, very much engaged in the brokerage business.
And it seems like the market truly rewarded the company for that aggressive growth approach, with the stock trading at 9x book value just before the crash of 29.
Yeah, extraordinary. Extraordinary. I remember in my career, Lloyds Bank of the UK trading at 6x book. But outside of maybe HDFC Bank, there are some banks in some emerging markets, in developed markets. It's difficult to recall. It's difficult to imagine a bank, particularly one, don't forget, which had already experienced the cyclical downturns we've just discussed, to trade at such a high multiple of book value.
Well, from there, it was clearly a long fall once the crash did come. And this is where Charles Mitchell comes in again, because he didn't really follow Howard Marks's advice on actually being right if you're going to go against the market.
Exactly. He was buying all the way down. To be fair to him and Jim Grant of Grant's Publications has written quite extensively about Charles Mitchell and has a slightly more positive view on him than maybe historians do. But he was buying all the way down. And as I say, to be fair to him, it was to protect the stock price. Clearly he lost a lot of money, and actually he went into a lot of debt. He ended up selling stock to his wife in order to minimize his tax liability, which got him into problems with the tax authorities, who actually brought him to court. He was acquitted, but he resigned from the bank in 1933. And actually, Senator Glass, the man behind Glass-Steagall, and again at the time, very similar, absolute foreshadowing of some of the events that occurred and some of the commentary around bankers in 2008, 2009. But Charles Mitchell was seen by lawmakers such as Senator Glass as being absolute stereotypical banker, who and actually a lot of the blame for the crash of 1929 was pinned on him personally.
And then fast forward a bunch of decades, the next really significant episode seems came in 1990 or thereabouts, right after Citigroup took some provisions on Latin American debt and then was floored by exposure to commercial property developers at home. And then we had another big investor step up.
Well, that's right. And just as an aside, it's quite interesting. It took a long time. There's a long time between 1933 and 1990. And again, it kind of reflects this idea of a benign period that follows a period of absolute distress. Citi ran into problems in the 80s, lending to developed markets, took a lot of provisions in 1980, in 1987. But in 1990, it was in a lot of problems because not only did it not really cleared up those developed market exposure issues, but also then it was a victim of the commercial real estate crisis that was carrying on in the US at the time. The stock was collapsing. One investor stepped up, Prince Al Waleed of Saudi Arabia, member of the Saudi royal family. He initially, at the end of 1990, he on the open market bought up Citi stock. He spent about $12, $13 a share on average buying up that stock. And then the following year in 91, when Citi needed to raise capital in order to shore up its balance sheet, they approached him and a preferred stock deal was structured. Prince Al Waleed put in another almost $600 million. So in total, he'd invested $800 million. And the conversion price of that preferred was about $16, $17. And it was a very, very successful trade. The lows were in. 12, 13 were the absolute lows of that time, dollars a share. And throughout the next several years, 90s going through all the way, even in spite of some wobbles in 98. By the time 2000 came, 10 years later, the stock was trading up at $500. So from his in price of $12, that was quite a significant return.
And I think the stock continued to do well through 2007. And then when the mortgage crisis blew up in 2008, another foreign investor was eager to step in, maybe motivated by the experience that Prince Al Waleed had had.
Exactly. It never saw its 2000 highs. It treaded water over the next 6 years, for what it's worth, up to 2006. But absolutely right. 2007 came along. Citi found itself with huge exposure to subprime. It put up its first loss in its third quarter, would have been its third quarter. So it fi published its third quarter 2007 numbers in October 2007. Huge losses. And the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund approached Citi to replicate the same kind of preferred structure that Prince Al Waleed had benefited from all those years earlier, kind of 16, 17 years earlier. And they put $7.5 billion into this thing. But the problem is, and again, Howard Marks is a great quote, something all investors know, being too far ahead of your time is indistinguishable from being wrong. And what the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund did was they bought on the first loss, but it wasn't the last loss. And most of that $7.5 billion was wiped out.
Well, one investor who wasn't wrong or early was David Tepper.
Exactly. So he didn't buy on the first loss. He didn't buy on the second loss. Actually, in City's case, there was probably a third or even a fourth loss. City made lows in January of 2009 when already other firms that had recognized their problems earlier, like Goldman, were recovering. They were already recovering. And in 2009, this is where my personal story kind of intertwines with that of City, because we were at my fund short going into a event in January 2009 where City converted forcibly all of its preferred into common. So it built up its balance sheet strength through a conversion of preferred to common, including the conversion of some of the government's preferred, and the huge dilution that that caused, obviously, was very negative for the stock price. But coming out of that, that was a buying opportunity. And what David Tepper did was he bought very famously in 2009. Arguably, he made some, his fund, Appaloosa, made something like $7 billion for its investors in 2009 in bank stocks, just in bank stocks, one of which was City. And he bought the City preferreds, which converted into City Common below $10. According to the 13F filings, he was out by the end of 2014 when the stock was about $50. So 5x return, maybe a bit more, not as good as Al-Waleed, although actually Al-Waleed would have lost a lot of money subsequently, because the $500 that I mentioned earlier was never seen again, and the stock's now trading at kind of $60. So adjusting for splits and reverse splits, Al-Waleed rode it from 12.5 up to 500, but then it came all the way back down again to 10, actually, which is where Tepper got in.
And now we come to Jane Fraser, who takes the CEO job on March 1st, I guess, 2021. She seems to have three key targets in mind for Citi.
She does. She does. So the first one is the regulatory issues. Citi has always been embroiled in regulatory issues with its regulators. There was a story just in February of this year that they wired out accidentally $900 million to various hedge funds, some of whom gave it back. Those sitting on 500 million didn't give it back. Citi sued. They lost that case, various technical reasons of law as to why they lost that case, but they lost that case. And it got double negative whammy for them. One, they lost $500 million. And two, the regulators thought, well, hang on a sec, what kind of operating systems are in play to allow such a ridiculous error to happen? And back in October of last year, a consent order was slapped down on Citi together with a $400 million fine. So they were fined. They're under this consent order, which has all sorts of ramifications. They are under particularly intense scrutiny from regulators right now. They can't make acquisitions, all sorts of issues, none of which is new. Citi was under the regulatory spotlight back in 2009. And then if we go back through history, back in the earliest example I come up with in 1900, actually. Very, very big organization, very difficult to manage, that consistently runs into regulatory problems. And it was only really coming back to Moses Taylor in his time, we're going back a long, long time, but it was only really in his time where the regulators, and there's a great example possibly of regulatory capture, regulators love this guy. And it's a benchmark. It's a very high hurdle for Jane Fraser, but certainly she's got her work cut out for her. And it is her first target is to ingratiate herself and the group more broadly, once again, with regulators, because that's important.
She says she wants to position City to win. Do we know what that actually means, especially in the context of City being a global bank?
Yeah, I think it's about market shares. I think City's active in a lot of markets, and in a lot of product areas. The prior CEO, Mike Corbett, already cut back some of Citi's exposures, pulled out of consumer banking in some markets, particularly in Latin America, for example. But she, I think, wants to focus resources where they can win, where they've got a material enough market share to make a difference. That could mean pulling back on some of the other global ambitions, particularly around consumer. So on the commercial side, it's a core feature. And again, if we go back through history in 1903, actually, just as an interesting aside, throughout Citi's history, and Robert Rubin would be the closest, most recent example of this, of personnel that have moved seamlessly between government, treasury roles, for example, in particular, and the bank. And that goes back a long, long way. So in 1903, the assistant treasury secretary at the time quit his government job and went to work at Citi. And related to that, and I kind of mentioned that now because related to that, it helps explain a lot of Citi's global ambitions, that a lot of their global network and their global ambitions were linked to America being a superpower after the end of the Second World War, the Marshall Plan helping American businesses globalize and export the export these concepts of American business. So Citibank banked a lot of these multinationals, and that was reflected in a speech that this former assistant treasury secretary made back in the early 20th century. And even in the 1960s, when Citi's famously CEO, man called Walter Wriston, he was the first CEO to come from the international business, and very much aligned the strategy of the group to that of the international business, which in turn was aligned to kind of American foreign policy, really. So she's got to grapple with all of this. There's a lot of history there. There's a network now that in some cases is irreplaceable. The infrastructure is irreplaceable and makes it difficult to, and it is a competitive advantage in that sense. But at the same time, there are some consumer businesses, for example, in Asia, which maybe aren't showing sufficiently high market share, aren't profitable enough, and that's something that she might want to address.
Returns on capital are an issue where Citigroup seems to be earning 4 to 6 percentage points less than peers like JP Morgan and B of A. Do we have any color on how she plans to improve returns?
It's a tricky one. Part of it is part of the difference between Citi and those other banks is that Citi does have this global sprawl. It also runs slightly higher capital than those other two for various reasons, but that doesn't explain the full weight of that difference. The global sprawl we've spoken about is something she could potentially address, but the other issue, and this could become more of an issue if interest rates were to rise, is that the bank doesn't have the weight of non-interest bearing deposits that JP Morgan and Bank of America have. And part of that is because its deposit franchise in the US is smaller than theirs. Historically, it was a bank around New York. It's a kind of a metropolitan bank, doesn't have the network that Chase has and that JP Morgan subsequently acquired with Washington Mutual, or that Bank of America has. Actually, Citi, back in the aftermath of the crisis, tried to buy Wachovia, which ended up going with Wells Fargo, partly to address this issue, but it was never addressed and it can't be addressed now because this consent order forbids them from making an acquisition. So the alternative is digital banking and building up deposits that way. They're not so cheap. They tend to be more expensive deposits. So it is an issue, and it's something that in the short term, I'm not expecting her to make significant progress on in the short term.
Well, Citi shares certainly are not expensive, but at the same time, at 90% of book value, they also don't look like the bargain that Prince Alwaleed, David Tepper, were able to get in on.
That's right. That's right. I think if we've learned one thing looking at the history of Citi is that it will present opportunities for distress. I mean, clearly, we had one, although there were rich pickings in March of 2020. Actually, as well, even in the recent past, there's been episodes, for example, in 2012 around the Eurozone crisis. There was an example at the beginning of 2016 as well. So these opportunities do come along. It doesn't feel like we're in one right now at point nine of book, but they come along. And the other Howard Marks motto is this idea of patience.
We will try to be patient. Mark, thank you very much for the conversation.
Thanks, John.